And welcome back. This is a new edition of Dark Matters Radio. And tonight we're going to be talking to a gentleman I have known for almost 20 years. His name is Kevin Randall, PhD. You can also tack on Major Kevin Randall. He is a member of the Armed Forces, and we may even be touching on a little of that. Kevin, it's been a while since we've done anything like this. Welcome to the show, and how are you?
I'm fine, and I'm glad to have an opportunity to chat with you again, even if there's a lot of people listening in.
Well, there probably is.
We hope there are.
Tell me, Kevin, it's been quite a while since we've talked. To give the audience, if they're not familiar with you, an idea of some of the works that you've done, primarily, well, you're a fiction writer, but primarily in the realm of nonfiction. Just a few of the titles, for example. You are one of the premier investigators on the Roswell incident. Some of the things that you've done on that are, for example, the Roswell Report, a historical perspective. With your former associate, Don Schmidt, the truth about the UFO crash at Roswell. You've done works on things like Majestic 12, conclusions on Operation Majestic 12, which was created quite a stir roughly 20 years ago. The Randall Report on UFOs in the 1990s. Just, you know, as a matter of fact, I've got a whole list here. Are you still pretty much keeping in your hand in with that material?
Yes. How's that for a succinct answer? I have done a couple of magazine articles here and there dealing with UFOs, and I've just done a short book for the 60th anniversary that Fate will be publishing in the next few months. So we talked about the Roswell case, so it all ties into Roswell. Looking at it from the perspective of where we are in 2007, as opposed to where we were in 1997 at the 50th anniversary and in earlier times, we've learned an awful lot about the case. And after 1997, I was telling people that we're kind of back to where we were when Jesse Marcel, the air intelligence officer at the base there in Roswell, had come forward to talk about what he had seen, that we're kind of back to there, because some of the really good testimonies, the really exciting testimonies, Frank Kaufman, for example, talking about having been involved in the retrieval operation and describing the bodies and the craft and all of that, some of those testimonies had blown up in our faces. We found out that the people were being less than honest with us. They were inventing an awful lot of what they had to say about the Roswell case. And I sat down to do this thing, which started out as a series of articles for Fate magazine, but evolved into something a little bit more in-depth. And what I realized is we really weren't back to that point where we simply had a couple of military officers telling us about strange metallic debris, or the rancher telling us about strange metallic debris. But we had some good testimonies that had survived the onslaught of skepticism, had survived the problems we had with people making up their stories, so that we did have a link to the extraterrestrial based on accounts of what the bodies looked like and the retrieval of bodies and accounts of how the thing came down and that sort of thing. The Air Force, for example, in their report interviewed five people about the Roswell case. Three of them were from Project Mogul. And I'm thinking, if you want to understand the Roswell case, Project Mogul doesn't help you at all. And why not interview people such as General Arthur Exon, who had been a base commander at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in the mid-1960s, had been at Wright Field in 1947 when the debris came in, and gave us some very interesting comments about it. Why wouldn't the Air Force interview him about his recollections about the Roswell case? Why avoid him? And the only thing I could think of is they didn't want to be put in the uncomfortable position of having to call a general officer a liar about the case when they knew that the guy was telling the truth, so they just avoided that whole problem.
Well, you mentioned that some of the original witnesses that you talked to, you found out that in essence they've lied to you. Now, this is a phenomenon, if I can call it that, that seems to stretch throughout this entire field of inquiry. You have liars, you have wannabes, you have people that are sometimes what appear to be intentionally clouding the facts of cases. What do you attribute that to?
I think it's just an attempt to pull the spotlight to them. There's a powerful draw in human nature to get into the middle of the spotlight, to have people seek you out, to interview you, to have an opportunity to appear on national television, which explains strange things like Jerry Springer. Why would people go on his show to expose themselves to the ridicule, and yet he has no trouble gathering guests? And so part of it is this powerful draw of wanting to have a certain amount of celebrity. And so people will be making up their tales. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. Gerald Anderson, after the Unsolved Mysteries program appeared first in, I think, 1989, and then in January of 1990, Gerald Anderson called in to talk about how he'd been involved in the Roswell crash. He'd been over on the plains of San Augustine. He had seen it all. The family had documents to prove it. And initially, we accepted his testimony. And I say we... Don Schmidt and I accepted his testimony. Stan Friedman accepted his testimony. But as we investigated more about Anderson, it became clear that he was just making it up. Anderson claimed to have been a Navy SEAL, and the Navy SEALs used to have a wall of shame where they exposed people who claimed to be SEALs who were not, and Anderson's name was figured prominently on their wall of shame. I don't know if they have maintained that in the last few years or not. But Anderson, I think, came forward to talk about or inventing his tale simply because it gave him an opportunity to talk to people he'd seen on TV. It gave him an opportunity to appear on television himself. Stan Friedman arranged for him to appear on a number of television documentaries. Linda Moulton Howe did the same thing, arranged for Anderson to appear on some documentaries, even though there were some very legitimate questions about Anderson's testimony. I caught Anderson in a lie about... Wilfred Buskirk, who had been, he identified as an archaeologist on the plains of San Augustine, one of the archaeologists that had been talked about in the Roswell case.
Now, we may be getting a little esoteric for audience.
I'll wind it up here quick.
No. What I want you to do is to be a little more enlightening about who some of these people are.
Well, in the original Roswell story, there was a discussion about a group of archaeologists who'd stumbled upon the crash on the plains of San Augustine, part of the Barney Barnett story, which appeared in the original work about Roswell, having seen the craft and the bodies. So you have the link to the extraterrestrial. When Anderson came forward, he said that he'd been on the plains of San Augustine crash and that he had seen it all. He provided Stan with copies of a diary.
Stanton Friedman, a very well-known investigator.
Yes. Copies of pages from a diary his aunt supposedly kept. And he said that he knew who the archaeologists were. It was Winfred Buskirk. Dr. Buskirk was the lead archaeologist. Well, we found Winfred Buskirk. And he says, no, it wasn't me. I wasn't there. It didn't happen. We said, well, how did Gerald Anderson come up with this guy's name? And we were able to determine that Winfred Buskirk had taught a class in anthropology at the Albuquerque High School in the same years that Anderson attended the Albuquerque High School, and in fact had taken the class from Buskirk. So we had the connection between the two, and Anderson presented a transcript of his grade showing no class in anthropology. But when I talked to people at the school, originally, they said they looked at the transcript and said he'd taken it, the anthropology class, the first semester, and then switched over to France or French. But when he presented it, the grade had been altered. And then Anderson had called the school and threatened to sue them if they released any information about his his transcripts or his work at the school, so they wouldn't answer any more questions. So we kind of lost this opportunity. But then Anderson presented a phone bill that showed that he had talked to me for only 24 minutes. I had claimed that the call had lasted for nearly an hour. I think it was 54 minutes. Well, what happened is I managed to get a copy of the phone bill that Anderson had presented to another researcher, showing a phone call of 26 minutes, and a copy of the phone bill from Southwestern Bell that showed the call was actually 54 minutes. Anderson had faked the document.
So, in essence, you're just describing to much of the audience about some of the really detailed investigation, research, and factual evidence that has got to be done with this. Kevin, we've got to take a very quick break. Hang on just a moment. We're going to pick up there when we come back. This is Dark Matters Radio, and you are listening to the Bohica Radio Network. We are back, and my guest, Dr. Kevin Randall, also Major Kevin Randall. Kevin, I've known you long enough, I can just call you Kevin, huh?
I think so, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Or His Royal Highness, either way. You know.
All right, getting back to this now, you know, so many people that don't have a lot of background information on something that can be as esoteric as the study, research, investigation of the UFO phenomenon. This is something that a lot of people will just think simply encompasses weird things flying in the sky, occasional stories of that people have come forward that have seen occupants get off. But there's much more to this, isn't there?
There's a wide range of evidence, and it's often overlooked. But if you want to prove that something is going on, you kind of take a look at the investigation done in France in 1803 with the idea that rocks fell from the sky. And we in ufology are fond of saying, well, the French Academy of Science rejected the idea of rocks falling from the sky. We all know about meteorites today. But in 1803, 1804, there was a magnificent study done of a fireball that landed in France. And what you see is the investigator created multiple chains of evidence, meaning that he looked at the rocks, and the rocks were not native to this to the region of France. There had been a survey of the landscape just two or three years prior to this, so he could prove that this was not native rock, and here's all this rock. So he created a chain of evidence about the physical evidence of the rocks. He had a secondary chain of evidence that dealt with the eyewitness testimony of seeing the things fall from the sky, and there was a third chain of evidence that dealt with the environmental impact of the rocks hitting the ground. So you have multiple chains of evidence leading to the conclusion that rocks fell from the sky. When we look at the UFO phenomena, we can do the same thing. We have the eyewitness testimony. We have photographic evidence, some of it very, very good. We have incidents where the UFOs interacted with the environment. We have the instrumentality, if you will, of radar scopes, for example, displaying the objects on them with a corresponding eyewitness sighting of that same object. So we have these multiple chains of evidence leading to the idea that some of the UFOs are extraterrestrial spacecraft. And yet we have to put up with the skeptical community, the debunkers, taking one small aspect of this and saying, we don't believe it because this didn't happen. Well, it did happen. You just are overlooking that, or you're making something up. So we have to look at all of those sorts of things so we can understand where flying saucers are coming from, if you will.
Well, you know, over the years, when I was actively involved in investigation, research, what have you, I noticed that this subject opened up far wide and beyond simply seeing mysterious lights in the sky, for example. I have seen, and as you have, everything connected with this subject from the JFK assassination to claims that the HIV virus was genetically engineered to the fact that extraterrestrials were implanting fetuses in the wombs of women to removing fetuses. And the problem with so much of this has been that there's quite frankly no factual evidence. Do you get hit with this now, today? And if you do, how do you go about answering that? Because there is something genuine to this subject. I guess what we're trying to do is come to terms with what that genuine piece really is.
What the problem seems to be is the signal-to-noise ratio, which means simply we have a few very good UFO sightings with very good chains of evidence, and we have a lot of noise out there. And part of the noise is people just misidentifying things in the sky. You know, we laugh about the Air Force explaining a lot of UFO sightings as Venus, but frankly, a lot of people see Venus when it's at its very brightest and see it near the horizon and think it's an object hovering over there, and it slowly fades from sight.
Right.
Venus is responsible for an awful lot of UFO sightings, and that kind of hides the real phenomena hidden inside it. And that doesn't take into account all the hoaxes that we have to deal with, other misidentifications of natural phenomena, people being unfamiliar with what's in the sky, people confabulating. And by confabulating, I mean they see something and they add detail to it unconsciously. They don't realize that they're adding detail to what they've seen, but it becomes much more detailed and it hides what has really gone on. And we have to deal with all of that kind of nonsense when we should be focusing on the signal. We too often focus on the noise.
Well, you know, a perfect example of that, and I'm sure you'll recall this, back in the early 1990s, when the Area 51 story was the current flavor of the month, after television journalist George Knapp first exposed that there was something, this top secret base in Nevada, that had been for many years involved in cutting edge military research. And of course, it came out that there allegedly this site had been used to store recovered extraterrestrial craft, and the government was working on them. And people, charlatans in essence, in the field would take busloads of people out there, and they would observe 737 aircraft that were flying from Las Vegas to the test site with workers every day. And, you know, in the evening, you would see these lights flying in, and it would be, oh, look, there's another one, another one. And, you know, it's just, it's ludicrous.
It diverts attention away from what we should be doing, because now you've taken some of the very limited resources available to the UFO researchers, and you diverted them into watching, in essence, our development of the next generation of military aircraft, which has nothing to do with craft from other planets. And you can say the same thing. Look at the hullabaloo over the MJ-12 documents, which is still takes the limited resources of the UFO phenomena off in a direction that it doesn't need to go.
Well, now, that's a great place to explain what those documents allegedly were. Do you want to take it away there?
Oh my Lord. back in I think 1982, 1983, after Bill Moore had written the Roswell incident with Charles Berlitz with a helping hand from Stan Friedman about the Roswell crash, documents appeared at the home of a Hollywood producer, Jamie Shandera, who was Bill Moore's buddy, actually a 35mm undeveloped film appeared. When they developed it, they found these documents that alleged to be special report for President Eisenhower about the crash in Roswell, and a memo from President Truman in 1947 establishing a special committee to investigate the Roswell crash, the Majestic 12 Committee to investigate the Roswell crash. Since that time, literally thousands upon thousands of these documents have surfaced, and to my opinion, all of them are faked, but most UFO researchers will tell you that the original documents, the Eisenhower briefing document, which was one of the things that Bill Moore received first, the Eisenhower, or the Truman memo, and a couple of the other original documents were authentic, but everything else is a fake. So we have all these documents that purport to tell us about how the retrieval operation went in Roswell, New Mexico, a little bit about what the aliens looked like, a little bit about the investigation of that and the back engineering of all of that. So we had an awful lot of people and still diverting an awful lot of their resources to determining whether or not these documents are authentic.
Okay, now, if I were to come to you today and say, Kevin Randall, you've written extensively, you've researched, you've investigated this incident that happened in Roswell, New Mexico in 1947. If you search your heart of hearts, do you believe or do you not believe that an extraterrestrial craft of some type impacted there?
Oh, I believe it was an extraterrestrial spacecraft. And I think if you take a look at the reaction of the military in 1947, you see something extraordinary happened. Project Mogul, this secret balloon operation they had going on at the same time in New Mexico, doesn't explain the debris and some of the testimony that we've gotten from Roswell. And what is interesting is the UFO phenomena sort of begins in June of 1947 with Kenneth Arnold seeing his objects near Mount Rainier. For the 2 weeks after that, there's all kinds of speculation in the newspapers about it, what it is. There's all kinds of stories about others seeing similar things in the sky. There's statements by military personnel about them not knowing what it is. There's statements by scientists trying to figure out or provide explanation for what it is. Then on July 8th, about 2 weeks or 3 weeks after Kenneth Arnold makes his sighting, you have a story appearing in the newspaper that says the Army has found a flying saucer in Roswell. 3 hours later, you get an awful lot of stories saying, no, it was just a weather balloon, forget about it.
No, wait. Now, this is very important that must be stressed. They didn't say we found pieces or parts. They said we recovered a flying disc.
They said a flying saucer, actually. But
well, potato, potato. They claim a craft. They found a flying saucer, a disc.
But there's a point that is critical here that I wanted to make, which is that's July 8th, 1947. They say we've got a flying saucer. 3 hours later, they say no, we've made a mistake. It's a balloon. You know, cover story. Clearly a cover story. Told us general officers who were involved in that told us it was a cover story. But on July 9th in the newspapers, we read, the Army and Navy has moved today to suppress the stories of flying saucers whizzing through the atmosphere. Why on July 9th did they suddenly care about people speculating about flying saucers? 2 weeks prior to that, they didn't care. Now they care and they want the stories to stop, and the number of sightings reported and all of that drops off precipitously in the newspapers. The Pentagon is still very agitated about what's going on, and if you read Ed Ruppelt's book, Ed Ruppelt being the chief of Project Blue Book in the 1950s, he'll tell you that in July of 1947, the Pentagon was highly worried about what was going on in the world of flying saucers, and yet they're attempting to suppress the stories. This tells you something extraordinary happened in New Mexico. Suddenly, they have a very good clue as to what the flying saucers are. I suspect they know they're extraterrestrial, and now they want an opportunity to exploit this find without having to worry about espionage from the Soviet Union or having to have our competitors in the world trying to get that information from us.
So, in essence, your bottom line is basically, you have no doubt that they recovered something extraordinary. Most likely, this was an extraterrestrial craft.
Yes. And, oh. And again, it's you know, Jesse Marcel, who was the Air Intelligence Office at the Roswell base, is on the record of saying, I mean, the videotape, the film footage exists of him saying, it was something that came to Earth, but it was not something that came from Earth.
Okay, now this is a great place to bring this forward. The United States government, the Air Force, have publicly admitted that they lied about this, that yes, what we said before was a lie, on three occasions. They changed their story about what it was. First, it was a weather balloon. Then it was a Project Mogul balloon. Later on, they muddied the waters by claiming that the bodies that were alleged to have been seen by witnesses were in actuality anthropomorphic dummies dropped from parachute tests that incidentally didn't take place until years after the Roswell event. They described this as a problem with time compression, which is something I had never heard before. I mean, what is time compression?
Well, I believe what their theory is the fact that people who saw the anthropomorphic dummies, which looked exactly like what they were,
dummies,
human dummies, saw them in 1957, and when we interviewed them in the 1990s, they compressed the time from 47 to 57, and they thought that the events were in those earlier years. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me, but when you watch the officer who is giving this explanation at the press conference in 1997, and you watch the press, you realize nobody's buying this ludicrous idea at that time. Now there's people that say, yeah, it was anthropomorphic dummies. Just a preposterous explanation.
Well, you know, I have their report, Kevin, as I'm sure you do, that they released, you know, Roswell case closed. And at the time that he was making that briefing, I was in the NBC studios here in Southern California in Burbank. And as a matter of fact, went on MSNBC right after his briefing. And then later on, I think that same night, I was on Brokaw's NBC News talking about it. And the thing that just astounded me, when I leafed through the report, they had photographs in there of space probes and various things that, you know, if you weren't familiar, would look like a flying saucer, except these probes were from the 1960s, the 1970s, and I had to think in my mind that these guys are intentionally trying to muddy the water.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The real question that should be asked is, if there's not something there, why did the Air Force care in 1997 or 1995 when they began their investigation? What a bunch of UFO nuts had to say. You know, they said for years, we stopped investigating UFOs in 1969 with the close of Project Blue Book, and yet in 1994, 1995, 1996, they're investigating UFOs again. And it's all precipitated by a bunch of us UFO nuts saying that the Air Force had picked up a flying saucer.
Is that your cell phone?
Yeah, it was.
Shame on you, Kevin.
I get so few phone calls on it, I don't know why anybody would call me on that thing. Looking at this whole thing, you know, you're wondering, why would the Air Force care what we're saying if there's not something there?
Well, here's one
and then,
more.
And then they don't even do a good investigation of it. There's a point where they're talking to Sheridan Cabot, who was a counterintelligence agent in Roswell in 1947, who originally said, no, I wasn't even there at that time. And, well, I was assigned to the base, but I wasn't physically present. And then finally said, yes, I did go out with Jesse Marcel to look at it. And he says, talking to the Air Force investigator, when we got out there, I recognized it for a balloon. And I'm thinking, my next question to this guy is going to be, did you bother to communicate this rather vital bit of intelligence to Jesse Marcel? But the Air Force investigator skips over that question because it can't be answered. Because clearly, if Cavett's out there and he knows it is a balloon, he's going to say, Jess, this is a balloon, let's go home. And that's the end of it. But Jesse Marcel believes it to be something extraordinary. He takes parts of the debris back to the base in Roswell, shows it to Colonel Blanchard, the base commander, and Blanchard orders the press release issued. Now, you know that Blanchard talked to Cavett, and you would think Cavett would have said, geez, Colonel, it's a weather balloon. Let's not go out on a limb on this. And so we have this problem with the Air Force investigators not asking the question that needed to be asked.
Well, let's talk a little more. We've got to take another quick break, but let's talk a little more about what the military did and what they didn't do when we come back. This is Dark Matters Radio. You are listening to the Bohica Radio Network. We're going to be back in just a moment. All right, my guest, Dr. Kevin Randall, PhD, and we are discussing the military and that very unusual event that happened in Roswell in 1947. Kevin, you know, for a long time now, the mantra from the military has been, hey, what's all the excitement? It was just a Project Mogul balloon. Now, a lot of people may not know what Project Mogul was. It was, in essence, off-the-shelf material that the Army Air Corps, the Army Air Force, was using to listen for Soviet nuclear devices being detonated. Now, the one problem I've always had, this was just 2 years after the United States, who originally developed and then deployed the A-bomb, we were the only people that had it. Now, why would we have been listening for a Russian nuclear test when our own intelligence agencies said that the Soviets probably wouldn't have anything until the mid-50s? Although, because of American traitors and spies, the Soviets did set off one in 1949, but still, that was 2 years away. Do you think that that particular cover story has had problems from the beginning?
It has problems. It certainly has problems. Mogul was really to develop a constant level balloon. I think the theory was there's an acoustical level in the atmosphere equivalent to the acoustical level in the ocean. If you put a microphone in this acoustical level in the ocean, I think it's 200 feet below the surface, you can hear incredibly long distances and get incredible information that way. And they postulated there would be an acoustical level in the atmosphere like that, and they wanted to put balloons into that acoustical level and keep them there with microphones to listen for the detonation of Soviet weapons. So Mogul was designed to do that, to put the balloons up there. But the key is, as you said, that the balloons were off-the-shelf equipment. Yes, they tied a bunch of them together, and they put a number of Raywin radar targets, and these were these aluminum foil covered targets with a whole bunch of different facets on it, so that radar would bounce off it directly, and they would get a good solid image of where it was, so they could check the drift of the balloons and that sort of thing. But there's nothing there that Jesse Marcel should have not been able to recognize. Sheridan Cavett says he did recognize it, but didn't bother to tell anybody. But Mogul was the purpose of Mogul, the ultimate purpose of Mogul, as you say, was to put this thing up into the atmosphere to listen for the Soviets. But the equipment itself was not classified, and 2 days after the announcement in the newspapers that Roswell had captured a flying saucer, there were pictures in the newspapers around the country of them launching Mogul balloons.
That's yes, how important this was. This top secret project.
Yes, the first balloon, the first pictures that I saw appeared in the Alamogordo newspaper on July 10th. I've since found similar pictures in an El Paso newspaper and a Syracuse, New York newspaper. In other words, this is Project Mogul exposed to the public and the Soviet spies if they want to look at it. And that tells you that they're, if they're using this for the cover story, then what they found in Roswell was even more important.
Well, now, this is a great time to point out a couple of things. Now, we all have recently experienced the firing of several general officers associated with the Walter Reed Medical Center debacle, where Walter Reed, which at one point was the crown jewel of especially the Army medical services, guys, gals coming back from the Middle East that have been wounded, that have been disabled because of combat and other things. I mean, you know, there were some basically very atrocious conditions at these medical centers in some of the buildings. And as a result, the military was embarrassed. And these general officers were fired, were forced to retire. Now, the military, and I think you will agree with me, has always treated personnel that have embarrassed them somewhat harshly. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
Okay, now, here is a case in point where the United States Army Air Force's most elite organization in the world in 1947, the 509th Bomb Group, the people that dropped the atomic weapons that ended the Second World War, embarrassing the United States government. But yet the commanding officer at the 509th at that time later was promoted to a four-star general.
And probably would have been the Air Force Chief of Staff had he not died of a heart attack in the Pentagon.
His intelligence officer, Major Marcel, before he retired, or when he retired, was a lieutenant colonel.
I'm not sure if he retired or he just ended his active duty service, but...
But he was a lieutenant colonel.
Yes.
Now, if he would have been...
Walter Hott, who issued the press release. Never heard word one from the Pentagon about the press release.
That's true. But yet all these guys were promoted. So that tells me, from the standpoint that the military was not upset with them. Wouldn't that seem to suggest that?
It would appear that they did nothing wrong, and you can look at the firing using your analogy at Walter Reed, that some of the guys caught in the fallout over that really hadn't done anything wrong. It was just it happened on their watch and they're gone. So if we had Sheridan Cabot at Roswell, the counterintelligence officer, Captain Sheridan Cabot, retired as lieutenant colonel, if we have him knowing that it's a weather balloon, in essence, Project Mogul, weather balloon, not telling Blanchard, not telling Marcel, not telling anybody that it's a weather balloon, shouldn't he have caught some flack as well?
Well, one would think so. Now, let's take a look at some of the individuals that have gone seemingly out of their way to cover up or to basically turn the Roswell thing into nothingness. Now, you, over the years, have had a number of encounters with people like J. Bon Johnson, who was one of the photographers that went down to Fort Worth when Jesse Marcel was ordered to Fort Worth with this debris. And General Ramey, who was the commanding officer at the time of the 8th Air Force, was the individual that staged a press shoot, wasn't he?
General Ramey had J. Bon Johnson come. Well, J. Bon Johnson was sent out by the Fort Worth newspaper, the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, to General Ramey's office because they had gotten a word that some of this debris from Roswell was coming into Fort Worth, and Johnson was dispatched out there to talk to Ramey and get some photographs of it, yes.
Now, I think everybody knowledgeable about this case today will admit that it's most likely that Ramey ordered some common balloon debris to be switched out with whatever it was that Marcel took down there. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
Okay.
In fact, General DuBose, Ramey's chief of staff, he was a full colonel at the time, DuBose, told us on videotape that the debris in Ramey's office had been switched.
Well, now you can't get much better than that, can you?
That's kind of what I thought.
What was the deal with Johnson, the photographer that took the famous photograph of Marcel kneeling down on the floor with this piece of obvious balloon debris?
Well, Raywin target debris, but same difference. I'm not sure. Johnson, I found Jaybon Johnson through just a fortuitous good luck. I had written to or called the Special Collections Division at the University of Texas Libraries in Arlington to get copies, good copies of the photographs. And the woman I talked to told me that she had just met with the photographer that took the stuff. And I said, geez, I'd like to talk to this guy. And she said, well, I can't tell you who it is. It wouldn't be ethical. I said, well, if I send you a letter, would you send it on to him? And she said, yeah, she'd do that. So I wrote a letter, sent it to her, and she sent it on to Johnson, and Johnson called me. And we chatted about this on a couple of occasions, and I wrote a story about what he had seen and what he observed in General Ramey's office. Well, then Bill Moore and Jamie Shandera got involved in it and started talking to Jaybon Johnson, and suddenly his story changed, that it wasn't a weather balloon, as General Ramey had said. It was, in fact, the real debris, and he'd photographed the real debris, and he suddenly wanted to move himself from the position of this rather small but important role in the Roswell case into something much more important and much larger role, and changed his story radically from this wonderful story of him going out to the office to the fact that Ramey didn't know what it was when he got there, that he wrote the story on, and then this is kind of funny, he wrote the story that appeared in the newspaper the next day in the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, and the last paragraph says that General Ramey identified it as a balloon. And I said to him, after he had changed his story, I said, well, gee, you know, you said you wrote this article, and the article you said General Ramey told you it was a weather balloon. How do you explain that? And suddenly he said, well, I didn't write that article. Would you like to hear yourself tell me four times on tape that you said you wrote that article? So Johnson wanted to expand his role into a much more central role in the Roswell case. He had a nice little role in the periphery of the thing, and he took some photographs that we're very grateful to have. And in fact, one of the photographs shows Ramey holding a piece of paper, and if you blow the photograph up large enough, you can actually read some of the words on it. Unfortunately, you can't read very much of it, and there's no real critical words that you can read, but you can actually see some of the message that Ramey's holding there.
So it seems like Mr. Johnson was affected by that celebrity disease.
Yeah, exactly. But he had his role was very important, and he did take the photographs of two photographs of Marcel, two photographs of Ramey, and two photographs of Ramey and DuBose with this weather balloon debris. There, we have found a seventh photograph that was taken by somebody else. I suspect it was taken by the public affairs office or officer at the Fort Worth Army Airfield at the time. But we've got a seventh photograph of one of the weather officers there, a guy named Irving Newton, with the debris. And he says, yeah, I walked into the room. I knew immediately what it was. That this debris in Ramey's office was clearly a Raywin target and weather balloon. He said, I'd launched thousands of them, including a whole bunch of them at the Battle of Okinawa. So, I mean, here's a guy that recognized a balloon right away, and Ramey told him he thought it was a balloon, and apparently Cabot recognized it as a balloon but didn't bother to tell anybody.
Okay, now, this brings me to another point or item that I wanted to bring up with you. Recently, you've been under attack by, and I can only describe this person as an absolute, total, fraudulent moon bat. Huh?
Loon?
Loon will work also. A guy by the name of Cal Korf. Now, a number of years ago, Korf wrote a book exposing, once again, as if it needed it, the Billy Meyer business, you know, our space brothers from the Pleiades. And I can't really knock Korff for the work that he did on the Meyer stuff. But more recently, he's been passing himself off as everything from an anti-terrorism expert to, I don't know, maybe he's Captain Kirk's right-hand man.
That would make you Mr. Spock.
Yeah, it could be. But the thing that really upset me when I read it was an attack he made on you, not the least of which had to do with your Roswell work, but where he denigrated your recent service when you were called back to Iraq, and you served in Iraq in the United States military. And, especially when this guy has never done anything more than shoot his mouth off. And I've got actually several instances where Mr. Korff had to eat his words. Now, first off, what can you tell me about this guy?
Well, if you go to his website, and I'm not going to tell anybody how to find it, they'll have to search for it themselves if they really want to, you'll learn that he has an IQ of 219. And that's based on taking an Omni magazine self-administered IQ test. I'm not sure about the validity of a self-administered IQ test. In fact, I'm not really sure about the validity of any IQ test, but that's a whole other argument. So he's apparently one of the smartest people ever to walk the face of the planet. He's got a contract for 500 books. I don't know exactly what that means, but Stephen King doesn't have a contract for 500 books.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't think King could even. I mean, hell, I looked at your bibliography, and you've got a lot, but not 500 books.
Well, and if you could write one book a week, and I actually wrote a novel once in 6 days, and I wouldn't want to repeat that exercise, but it would take you 10 years of doing nothing else, and yet...
In the meantime, you wouldn't be able to be an anti-terrorism expert, would you?
Well, and Korff is talking about all these other activities he's involved in. And so it becomes very difficult to understand how he could write 500 books. Maybe he's going to edit 500 books. I don't know.
Well, now, he's passing himself off as what, the man from Uncle? Or is
he says that he is a captain in an Israeli anti-terrorism organization known as the... comes out S3, and I'm not sure, Special Security Service or Secret Security Service or Special Secret Security Service or something. I forget what the name of it is, and don't really care to know. And that he holds a commission as a captain in that organization. But as I've said repeatedly, nobody's ever heard of it.
The Secret Security.
But if you were a secret organization, that's probably... You'd probably be delighted that nobody's ever heard of you. And yet here's this guy on the internet writing magazine articles on the radio talking about this secret organization.
Well, you know, a number of years ago, on or about, 1996, 1997, when Art Bell was basically at the very pinnacle of his success, Korff was on a much smaller radio program with a guy by the name of Rentz, where he claimed that he was supposed to be interviewed on a radio station or several radio stations down in Arizona. And at the last minute, they bumped him because these stations were affiliates carrying Bell's program. And... basically, he claimed on the air that Bell stated that if they had Cal Korff on there, he would pull his show. Now, first off, probably very, very few people had ever even heard of Korff. So this got back to Bell. Now, are you familiar with this story?
Yes, I am.
Well, Bell... came on the air on his program and immediately said, there's no truth to any of this, and I'm going to get to the bottom of it. And he tried to get in touch with Korff, and of course, Korff was unavailable. But to make a real long story real short, Art said, well, fine, he's got X amount of time, like, I don't know, the next day, to get back to me about this, or my attorneys will be in touch with him. And the next thing you know, we had a very, very contrite Cal Korf coming on Art Bell's show stating that there was no truth to the fact that Bell had ever threatened anybody to have him kicked off the air.
And what's really funny...
Now, this is basically makes the guy a liar.
And what's funny about this is, at the time where I lived, they didn't carry the Art Bell show, so I never really heard it. But I was driving home from Las Vegas, and we were just approaching Denver, and it was late at night, and Art Bell was on the radio, and that's one of the few shows in that era time frame that I actually heard, and I heard Korf on the radio admitting that he had been less than honest with his treatment of Art Bell.
Well, this is a great time. We got to take that last break, Kevin, and when we come back, I want to talk to you more about what you did or didn't do that apparently got this guy's dander up. You are listening to Dark Matters Radio. This is the Boheka Radio Network. We'll be back in just a minute. Okay, we are back. My guest, Dr. Kevin Randall, PhD. Also, Kevin is an officer in the... Is it Reserves or National Guard, Kevin?
National Guard.
Okay, well, I want to touch on your recent Iraqi service, too, but let's get back to this Korf character. What exactly is it that you did that drew you into this clown's website?
He had appeared on a radio program, or an ongoing radio program or something, and said in an offhand manner that my service in Iraq was not as important as I'd made it out to be, and that the only reason the Army had called me up is because they had run out of people that they could use.
Oh, you're kidding.
And I'm thinking, well, duh. The National Guard was called up because the Army had run out of people that it could use. I mean, it was stretched thin. It needed the support of the Army National Guard and the Army Reserve. So that was what we do, what we train for that exact circumstance. So, yeah, that's exactly why they called us up. And I don't know where I had ever suggested it in his hearing.
Well, I'll tell you what. You know, the idea that, and I'm just going to be very blunt, that little pissant would say something like that. That just angers me. What has he ever done?
But what I did was on my blog, I just mentioned the incident and made a couple of comments about it.
I like the photograph you had of him in the green lantern costume. Where did you get that at?
I got that from Paul Kimbo. I remember Paul's last name for a minute there.
Well, you know, Kevin, after you hit 50, buddy, it's kind of tough.
It goes right in the dumper. But Paul, I got it from Paul's blog, and Paul had similar run-ins with Korf in the last year or so. Korf had claimed to have been an expert witness at the O.J. trial.
Yes, that's right. I had forgotten that. He was one of the expert witnesses
and
testifying.
Paul, being an attorney, and for some reason, since Paul is not a practicing attorney, Korf has decided he can't be an attorney.
So not only is Korf an award-winning author, writer, he's a legal expert.
Yes.
He's a captain in the Secret Services for the Israelis. I noticed that he, along with that note about his secret service, he mentioned what apparently can only be an Arab, a sheik, that was financing all this. Now,
yeah, I wondered about that too.
That's got to be a little odd. Even in today's topsy-turvy world,
they've got some. He's got some major contradictions in what he says. You know, at one point on one of these things, he said that I'd said I outranked him since I'm a major and he's only a captain. But, but I never said anything like that. But even had I said it, I would have been correct, because as you well know, you know, we have all these agreements with the militaries of foreign nations, and the rank structure sort of goes forward. So if I'm a major in the American Army, and he's a captain in some Israeli unit, I outrank him.
Yeah.
I'm a major and he's a captain. End of discussion. But
you know, if you encounter him, Kevin, if you encounter him,
he'll be doing push-ups.
I would force him to toss you a salute.
Well, I'd have him doing push-ups. Hop and give me 10 there, Captain Korf. So, but I'm also a major general in the State Guard Association of the United States. So.
All right.
That's even better.
Could I be a general too?
Yes, you could.
What do I have to do? I was only a sergeant, Kevin.
Yeah, but send in your $30 and put down your military experience and send in your $30 to be a general officer and poof, you are one.
All right. Does it mean that I get coffee cheaper at Starbucks?
Do you go to Starbucks?
Sure.
I think as a wounded veteran, you probably would get a better deal at Starbucks. And I know from my service, there are some places that give military discounts. So when I go to Popeye's Chicken, for example, I get 25% off my meal.
Well, let's talk about your last trip into Iraq, because this is a program we acknowledge our veterans frequently. And I know you spent, was it a year over there, the last trip?
We were deployed for 14 months. Part of that was training at Fort Riley, Kansas. Part of it was the deployment or the redeployment operation both in Kuwait and in Fort Riley. But we were gone from home for 14 months.
Well, you had that never forgotten experience of actually being in a firefight, didn't you?
I was involved in every one of the battalion's firefights, yes.
Well, I'll tell you, that's got to be something. You know, most people today, especially with the fact that there are so many that are never or never will be called to serve in our nation's military, that's something that most people don't really even comprehend other than what they see on TV. Kevin, I give you my greatest accolades for your service. I want to personally take this opportunity right now to thank you.
Well, I appreciate the words.
It's something I think that more and more people are beginning to realize that this truly is a very dangerous time. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I can't conceive of somebody thinking of the idea of flying an airplane into a building on purpose. I just don't, what sort of a mind would conceive that as retribution for support of one government for another government, and you don't like it, so you fly airplanes into buildings? I don't get it. But
well, you know, this is something, too, that many people are not aware of, that this enemy is unlike any enemy since at least the French-Indian War, in the fact that they are irregulars. Under the Geneva Convention, they are non-uniform, so they're illegal combatants, and these combatants are intentionally targeting innocent civilian men, women, children. This is what makes this particular fight so unique.
And for the longest time, they were afraid to come out and face the American soldiers.
Well, you know, Kevin, that if they did, American forces would hand them their butt on a plate.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And the thing that a lot of people don't understand is, under the rules of engagement that we operated on in Iraq, if the terrorist was hiding behind civilians, we were restricted on the fire we could put back on them, so that we wouldn't cause casualties among the civilian population. They don't operate under those rules. They don't care. In fact, they want us to kill innocent civilians because of the propaganda value of it. And so they try to set up situations where they target our soldiers in such a way that if we return fire, there's a good possibility that some of the civilians will get caught in the crossfire. And people in today's world become outraged at that. And I look back at World War II with Curtis LeMay and his concept of total war, where you destroy the enemy, and the enemy is everybody on the other side, man, woman, child, civilian, military, whatever. You destroy as much of the enemy as you can until he gives up. And in today's world, we try to limit all of that we do. We have what's called proportional response, and that sort of provides the bad guys with an advantage that they shouldn't really have.
Well,
to the detriment of our soldiers.
You're absolutely correct, and I'll tell you what I'm fearful of, that apparently until such time that we here in the United States lose a city or two, that the American public en masse just simply doesn't get it.
Well, here's something that I find interesting. If you remember, there was a picture taken of the police barricades right after 9/11.
Yes.
And there was a sign on it that says, "We will never forget."
Yes.
So now I know how long forever is, and it's about 4 years. Because we seem to have forgotten that these guys flew airplanes into buildings and killed thousands of people.
All right, let me ask you a quick question. When we went into Afghanistan initially, I had heard reports that one of the top Taliban leaders was being targeted, Mullah Omar, you know, the one-eyed guy?
Mm-hmm.
And that we basically had this monster in our sights, and that military attorneys were checked first before we dropped the hammer on them. And they said, no, you can't do it for whatever reason. I don't know what the reason was.
There's an even worse one. There's a satellite picture of 100-150 top Taliban and fighters in Afghanistan at the funeral of some leader who was killed, and a predator was overhead, a predator being a unmanned aerial vehicle, a UAV. They could have put a missile down on those and killed a whole bunch of them, and they determined that no, we can't do that because they're at a funeral.
Okay, my question is this: have we become, we the military, have they become so emasculated by political correctness that we have forgotten how to win a conflict? And you, as a serving officer, you would be the first guy I would ask.
And the first thing I'd have to say is, this is my opinion alone.
Yes, of course.
It certainly doesn't reflect the opinion of the Army or the United States government. But I would say that we seem to have lost the idea that if you're going to fight a war, you fight it to win. You don't fight it for some other outcome. You fight it to win. And we seem to get ourselves dragged into these conflicts where winning is not the option we put on the table. We have some other bizarre, esoteric goal in mind rather than winning. And when people talk about, well, gee whiz, what's the exit strategy for Iraq? To me, it's simple. The exit strategy is you train the Iraqis to take over their own security, and we come home. But no one seems to want to look at something that simple, and that is a way to accomplish it. We get off involved in all this other rhetoric that takes us nowhere. But the bottom line is, people have forgotten what started this. It wasn't George Bush worried about weapons of mass destruction. It was about people flying airplanes into buildings
and murdering 3,000 plus innocent civilians.
Yes, exactly. That's what started this. And Saddam Hussein.
Well, actually, Kevin, you're wrong, and I'm wrong, because this started long before. This started back in 1993, when the first attempt was made to destroy the Twin Towers. This started with the bombing of embassies in Africa. This started with the bombing of the Khobar Towers in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia.
Well, we can actually go back further than that. And we say this, you know, it started with the Gulf War in 1990 when Saddam Hussein decided he was going to take Kuwait.
Or this started in 84 with the bombing of the Marines in Beirut. But we did nothing for many, many years. Nothing. And it didn't matter if it was Republican or Democrat, Democratic administrations, although I really believe that the Clinton administration did more by not doing anything that harmed this nation than anybody had done in many years.
But what we really have to look at is Saddam Hussein was paying the families of suicide bombers.
Yes, he was.
$25,000 when the suicide bomber committed suicide by killing people. That's enabling people to engage in terrorism. And so, if for no other reason, he should have been eliminated.
Well, and he did something else that in my opinion, should have caused somebody to take him out. He attempted to murder a former president of the United States.
Yes. And I'm wondering if the younger Bush didn't have that in the back of his mind.
Oh, I'm sure he did.
As he ordered it. And here's something interesting. When they captured Hussein in Iraq, I was in Iraq at the time. And part of our unit was at Tikrit where they caught him.
Oh, really?
And the story was that the soldier that when they pulled the camouflage off the rat hole that Saddam Hussein was hiding in, the soldier said to Hussein, President Bush sends his regards. And I'm really hoping the guy actually said that.
Well, I always thought that what he should have done first was drop a fragmentation grenade down the hole and then went in to see what was left.
And I'm just kind of hoping he really said President Bush sends his regards.
Well, that makes a great story.
And we're in the Tactical Operations Center, and we're watching on satellite TV the feed of Bremer down in the Green Zone, and he's, what, 15 miles away from where we are, talking about that. And he walks across the stage, he stops, and he says, "We got him." And the cheering broke out down in the Green Zone. The cheering broke out in our Tactical Operations Center when he said that.
And that's a great place, I think, where we're going to end it today. We are out of time, Kevin. I want to thank you for coming on Dark Matters. I want to do it again.
I'd love to do it again.
All right. And in the meantime, do you have a website where folks can come up and read what you're up to?
I have a blog, which is at www.kevinrandle, all one word, and Randall is spelled R-E-N-D-L-E, .blogspot.com. And they can look at some of the stuff that I've said about Cal Corf. They can look at...
That's a great photo you have of him, by the way.
Well, there's another photo up in his captain's uniform. and there's other stuff on there. There's stuff about... the best UFO photographs. There's things about the Kinross case, which was the disappearance of an Air Force fighter chasing a flying saucer in 1953. So there's a wide range of stuff there. So you look in the archives, you can read some of the old stuff, and there's new stuff up there all the time.
Okay, so that is www.kevinrandle.blogspot.com.
Yes.
Okay. Well, that is it for another edition of Dark Matters Radio. Keep tuning in. We're going to be back very soon.